Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for coming. When I first began to think of how I might introduce today's speaker, I discovered a curious fact. To describe a person as a socialist is to say that he advocates and defends socialism. But to describe a person as a capitalist is to say that he is a practitioner of capitalism, that he is a businessman or a financier. Apparently, there exists no easy way, at least in English, to describe a person who advocates and defends the system of capitalism. But if we do not have the word, fortunately, we do have the person, in the person of Dr. Leonard Peikoff. By professional training, Dr. Peikoff is a philosopher. He took his doctoral degree in philosophy at New York University, where he studied under the renowned Sidney Hook. Since then, he has taught philosophy at a number of colleges and universities, and he has been a guest lecturer at countless more. In addition, his lectures on philosophy are now heard worldwide through an ingenious program of tape-recorded courses. Dr. Peikoff is also an author. His book, The Ominous Parallels, describes the philosophical trends that gave rise to Nazi Germany, and then compares those trends with the philosophical currents of post-war America. But above all else, Dr. Peikoff is the philosophical heir and successor to Ayn Rand. He was chosen by Ms. Rand to be the principal spokesman for her unique philosophical system, which she called objectivism. Since her death, Dr. Peikoff has joined with me in founding the Ayn Rand Institute, which is dedicated to propounding the objectivist philosophy. He serves as chairman of the Institute's board of directors. Dr. Peikoff has come here today to address the question, can capitalism survive? He is not here to tell you, and he would not presume to tell you, how to become champion capitalists, that is, champion businessmen. But he will tell you how to be something much rarer, something so rare that it does not yet have a name. He will tell you how to be champions of capitalism. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Leonard Peikoff.
Thank you very much, Ed. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I've been asked to make a political prediction this afternoon. Can capitalism survive? The American system today is not capitalism, but a mixed economy. In other words, a mixture of individual freedom and government controls, or of capitalism and socialism. Capitalism, properly speaking, means laissez-faire capitalism. In other words, a separation of state and economics. Under this system, there is no government interference in the economy of any kind, no special favors to any group, whether business, labor, farmers, consumers, or any other. Capitalism means a system in which the sole function of the government is to protect inalienable individual rights, to protect them from criminals or aggressors. The government leaves each individual with absolute sovereignty to pursue his own life, earn his own property, decide on his own actions and trades, so long, of course, as he doesn't attempt to initiate physical force or fraud against others. In other words, he has to respect the equal rights of other men to the same freedom as his own. This, in essence, is the original American system, as spelled out in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Obviously, we do not have this system anymore, only some last remnants of it. So I interpret our question today as referring to the element of capitalism that still remains. Can it survive? Well, in making market forecasts, as you know, for stocks, commodities, and the like, there are two common methods: the fundamental analysts and the technical analysts, or chartists. These two approaches are not necessarily restricted to the market. They're both applicable to political prediction as well, and I want to use them both on our question today. I want to begin with what we can call the fundamentalist approach. In regard to finances, this school holds that market predictions have to be based on the fundamentals in reality that actually determine price. In other words, on supply and demand and all the factors that ultimately determine them, such as management quality, nature of the competition, and so forth. All this is what influences people's decisions to buy or sell, and therefore is the basis for price predictions. Well, what influences people's decisions in politics? On what basis do people decide to buy one political system and sell out another? Politics is a realm involving abstract ideas and value judgments. And I think the answer is given by three abstract fundamentals. People's views in politics, I would say, result from what they think is good, from what they think is real, and from what they think is true. Now notice that I did not say from what they think is practical. Practicality by itself does not move the world. Capitalism is extremely practical, but that has not saved it from being rejected and eaten away across the decades. Socialism, by contrast, is monstrously impractical. It's been a disaster wherever it's been tried, but that hasn't prevented it from consuming half the world. The subject that deals with the three crucial issues I mentioned is philosophy. Philosophy lays the basis for politics. And on the big three issues, there are only two kinds of philosophy. One leads people to capitalism, the other leads them to its opposite, to some form of dictatorship. Capitalism depends on three fundamentals, which have to be our basis for any prediction about its future chances. In the pro-capitalist philosophy, the three take the following form. The good is selfishness. Reality is this world. The standard of truth is reason. Selfishness, this world, reason. Let's look at each. First, selfishness. Capitalism rests on what Ayn Rand called the virtue of selfishness. This is most obvious from the fact that capitalism rests on the profit motive, on men trying to improve their own conditions, to produce wealth, make money, achieve their own welfare. Now, when I say selfishness, I use the term in a specific sense, as defined in the objectivist philosophy. The selfish man, the exponent of rational self-interest, is the man who lives by his own mind and for his own sake. He neither sacrifices himself to others nor others to himself. Selfishness, according to objectivism, means each man is an end in himself, not a means to the ends of others. And therefore, men must deal with one another by trade, trading value for value, by mutual consent to mutual profit, as and when both sides voluntarily agree to trade. In other words, selfishness means each individual existing as an independent, self-supporting entity, recognizing the rights of others and expecting them to recognize his. This is the code of ethics that capitalism actually counts on and institutionalizes. The opposite of it is the ethics of selflessness, which is the idea that morality is service to something outside and above oneself, such as God or the state. The idea that self-sacrifice is the highest virtue. Now, self-sacrifice is not the same as helping others. It all depends. You can help a man selfishly if he is of value to you and you help him with a sum you can afford. For example, a personal friend. This is still an act to promote your friend, your value, and therefore your happiness. So it's still selfish. Self-sacrifice would occur when the recipient means nothing to you personally, and your action is a disaster to your own actual values. For instance, you help a stranger while letting your own child starve, and you do it on the grounds, well, others come above me and my happiness. That is self-sacrifice. Now, if that kind of code is virtue, then capitalism is evil. Capitalism does not appeal to men's desire to serve or renounce, but to pursue values and succeed. Not to give away wealth, but to create property and keep it. Not to suffer and sacrifice, but to enjoy themselves and live. If it is a man's moral duty to pursue his rational self-interest, then there is a basis for individual rights. Rights are a thoroughly selfish concept. Your rights are rights to what? To your life, your liberty, your property, the pursuit of your own happiness. But if a man's moral duty is service to others, then the individual is merely a means to the ends of others, of society. And then society has the right to do with him whatever it wants, which means the individual has no rights, he's a serf, as in communism and fascism, both of which preach and count on the ethics of self-sacrifice. Hitler and Stalin understood this issue thoroughly. Here's a brief quote from Mein Kampf. "This self-sacrificing will to give one's personal labor and, if necessary, one's own life for others is most strongly developed in the Aryan. The Aryan is not greatest in his mental qualities as such, but in the extent of his willingness to put all his abilities in the service of the community. In him, the instinct of self-preservation has reached the noblest form, since he willingly subordinates his own ego to the life of the community, and if the hour demands, even sacrifices it." Unquote. And of course, Hitler, if you know the history, made sure to enforce this code of ethics. If anyone objected to any of Hitler's commands and tried to assert himself, Hitler answered, "Who are you to question? Your duty is not to seek personal satisfaction, but to sacrifice." I regret to say that many businessmen today do not understand the moral issues involved as well as Hitler and Stalin did. They are eager to try to justify freedom and capitalism in terms of self-sacrifice, eager to appease their critics, to say that they are really selfless in running their firms and that their only goal is to help widows and orphans. This kind of claim is nonsensical. It's supposed to help the image of big business, and yet people clearly don't believe it. They know, the dumbest among them know, that business by its nature is production and fighting against competition to grow and prosper and cutting costs in every way possible and charging what the traffic will bear in order to maximize profit. All of that is the opposite of self-sacrifice, and it's impossible to even pretend differently. Try to imagine a consistent self-sacrificial businessman. He turns to his labor force. He's completely unconcerned with their ability or with the level of wages that he pays them. Their, quote, need is his only concern. "I'll pay huge salaries to inept workers," he says. "I'm not selfish." As far as his customers are concerned, he's happy to sell under the market price because, after all, quote, "I'm the servant of my customers. I'm here to sacrifice myself." If he does make any money, of course, it's selfish to keep it to expand and improve his own business. He gives it away to the hungry mouths in the third world because he's not actuated by, quote, "greed and the vicious profit motive." Now, this kind of mentality would be out of business in a flash. His business would be cannibalized out of existence. He could only survive if he got a job in Washington. The appeasing businessman thinks that he is improving his image, All he is doing, in fact, is make business come across as a guilty hypocrite. He is encouraging the Ralph Nader types and their legion of descendants to make ever more brash demands. This type of businessman says, in effect, to the public in full-page ads, "Yes, true, I do make a profit, but I'm going to give it all away soon. I live only for you. Please be patient." And the Nader types answer, "More now. If it belongs to the people, we want it now." And so we have the spectacle of American business with all of its resources on the defensive, being eaten alive. And why? Because businessmen feel guilty. Guilty of the ethics inherent in capitalism. Capitalism rests on the ethics of selfishness. It is not surviving under the code of self-sacrifice. That's point one. Now, the second pillar of capitalism is reality. And I mean this reality, the one we live in and perceive by our senses. You've undoubtedly heard capitalism denounced as too materialistic, and therefore the critics charge as low, vulgar, crude. Instead of the higher things in life, they say, capitalism is concerned with money, technology, gadgets, plumbing, as they sneer at it. In short, the physical. Let's ignore here the fact that it takes enormous intelligence to create material wealth. We can ignore this for a moment because there is an element of truth in the present charge. Capitalism is a secular system. It is concerned with this world, not some other dimension. It does not offer men heavenly bliss, but material rewards and earthly happiness. Now, there is, the anti-capitalists say, another world. There are two realities, the physical world and another higher non-material dimension, the exact opposite of this earth, and that dimension, they say, is true reality and man's true destiny. Now, the people who believe in this kind of dimension call it by many names, such as Plato's forms, or God, or Nirvana, or the Moony Heaven, or the final stop of the Cocaine Express. But what they unite on is that this world, our world, is not the final reality. It's only temporary, and we should rise above it. We should resist the temptation to enjoy it. Our goal should be to get out of it. Now, on that basis, capitalism is certainly a corrupt system. Capitalism rests on a philosophy of one reality, this one. It rejects the idea of a supernatural dimension. It accepts this earth as final, and therefore as the exclusive object of man's concern. According to capitalism, you should exploit the earth to the fullest and use your brain to invent and invest in physical improvements and gadgets and plumbing and color TV and luxury automobiles and computers and spaceships. Men should build ever more advanced technology and grow and constantly improve the material conditions of their life because, this is it, life is thought and action. Getting an idea, then giving it physical form on earth. The heroes among men are not, therefore, the mystic who scorns this life or the 1960s-style hippie who lives out of garbage cans or in back-to-nature communes, but rather the materialistic industrialist who masters nature and creates abundance. Historically, capitalism developed only with the rise of a this-worldly attitude, only when belief in the supernatural began to fade in the 15th and 16th centuries. It was impossible even to conceive so long as the West was ruled by belief in another dimension. Some people say that America was based on a supernatural or Christian philosophy. This is not true. Neither historically nor philosophically. The founding fathers were men of the Enlightenment era. Comparatively speaking, they were non-religious. They were deists, which means, relative to the Puritans who preceded them, they were virtual unbelievers. God was largely lip service to them. In their view, or according to most of them at least, he started the universe off, then he retired, went out of business and was not a factor in life thereafter. In other words, they didn't take religion seriously, as preachers at the time bitterly complained. If you want to study the chances of capitalism in a truly religious country, where they do take supernaturalism seriously still today, you need look no further than the Mideast. The Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, for example, is a true representative of supernaturalism, not just of Islam, because in principle he represents the same creed as the Middle Ages did in the West, the same anti-pleasure, anti-music, anti-freedom, anti-this life. And you see what chance rights, money-making, or capitalism have in that kind of atmosphere. Observe that the one group in most countries around the world that is as fanatically anti-capitalist as the communists is the religious fundamentalists, who stop at nothing to attack the hated United States for being too secular. You may recall that when Mr. Sadat was assassinated a while back, no one knew at first whether the killers were devout religionists or atheistic communists. Either or both together would have been plausible, because for all their posturing as being enemies, the two groups work together around the world whenever it suits their purpose in destroying their common enemy, the capitalist, or more accurately, semi-capitalist West. How can religion and communism cooperate with each other? They hold the same fundamentals, regardless of their differences on lesser issues. They both preach self-sacrifice and denounce capitalism for being selfish. And they both preach a supernatural world and denounce capitalism for being this worldly. On this point, the communists are indirect. Their goal, they say, is the future, which they claim is a dimension contradicting everything we know about the present, and which we are unable to understand now but must take on faith. That's their version of the supernatural. And notice also a third similarity. Both groups are opposed to reason, to the mind. The religious fundamentalists demand faith and revelation and openly scorn reason. The communists are materialists. Metaphysical materialists. In other words, they say man is merely a chunk of flesh and bone. There is no such thing as the mind. And that leads me to number three, the last of the three big issues, the third fundamental of capitalism, reason. By reason, I mean the faculty that starts with the evidence of the senses and then uses the method of logical thought to reach and prove conclusions. The opposite of reason is mysticism. The idea that man can acquire truth by some non-sensory, non-rational means, such as intuition or instinct or revelation or faith. On this issue, too, capitalism has been repeatedly attacked. You hear it said that capitalism is a cold, unfeeling system, that businessmen are interested only in facts, figures, balance sheets, efficiency, that they don't operate according to mystic feelings, but according to disciplined rationality. This charge is, in essence, true. Not of every businessman, of course, and judging by its curriculum in the business school, not of the ones who go to Stanford, but it is true of the successful ones, to the extent that they succeed by their own effort, as against government pull. Just as capitalism rests on this reality, so it rests on the power and value of man's reason. Capitalism is the greatest system of production in all history. Why? Because production for man is primarily an act of the mind. There is plenty of manual labor in the undeveloped world, but they're starving. What they lack is not muscles and not politicians, but men like Edison and Carnegie and Hill and Ford and what made them possible. Capitalism is the system of greatest wealth because it is the only system that exalts science, intelligence, the mind. It's the only system that leaves men free to think. I said that the essence of capitalism's politics is the recognition of individual rights. Rights are the right to act how? Not as someone orders you to, but according to your judgment, your thought, your best conclusions. Man's mind says capitalism is his means of survival, so it must be left free to function. No one and no government can properly try to force the mind of another. This prohibition against initiating physical force is the essence of recognizing man's rights. The governing principle is the supremacy of reason, and therefore the rejection of brutality as a means of dealing with others. Under the reign of mysticism, by contrast, when reason is out of the picture, then persuasion and peaceful, rational dealings among men are also out, and force, brute force, is in. And then somebody has to order men what to do and enforce it by the power of a gun. In the long run, it's either reason and capitalism or unreason and dictatorship. Such are the three fundamentals of capitalism that we have to survey to make our forecast. If people accept man as an end in himself, if they accept this world as reality, if they accept the validity of reason, then the demand for capitalism will be enormous, and it will survive and triumph. If people turn against these big three, however, then the demand for capitalism will shrink away to nothing, and therefore very soon so will the supply. How then are these fundamentals faring today in the United States? The men who deal professionally with ideas, who shape America's basic trends, set the country's direction, and take the rest of us along with them are the intellectuals, the liberal intellectuals and the conservative intellectuals. Here is a mini survey. In regard to selfishness, the liberals preach self-sacrifice in a Marxist form, stressing our duty to serve the poor or the workers or the so-called downtrodden. The conservatives preach self-sacrifice just as intensely in a Christian version, stressing our duty to serve God or the nation or humanity as a whole. In regard to reality, the liberals typically say, reality? Who can say what that is? There is no reality. There are no absolute laws in any realm, including economics. The conservatives typically say, reality means God and a spiritual dimension, and we must resist our low physical nature, including the craving for more and more wealth, for sexual enjoyment, for earthly pleasures. In regard to reason, the liberals say you can't be certain of anything. Reason is impotent, truth is subjective, all we can do in the end is obey. Obey the consensus of society as represented by the government. This is what they call democracy. The conservatives say that faith comes above reason, that man's destiny is not to think independently, which they curse as the sin of pride, but also to obey. Of course, in their version, you don't obey society, but God or his representatives and ministers, such as the church or Jerry Falwell. In politics, as a result of their view on fundamentals, both these groups are equally anti-capitalist. The liberals are moving us gradually toward dictatorship by advocating ever more government controls over the economy. As a small example, consult the latest pastoral letter of the Catholic bishops. The conservatives are moving us equally toward dictatorship, despite the anti-liberal noises they make, because they insistently demand even worse government controls over such crucial realms as morality, literature, sex, science, medicine, education. The liberals want economic controls. The conservatives want thought control. Both groups, therefore, are statist. They differ merely on which new regulations to impose and how fast. Our fundamental analysis does not look hopeful. Let's turn to the Chartist or technical approach and see what result it yields. In regard to the market, the technicians say that the fundamentals are summed up in an appropriate chart or graph. and that what you have to do is plot the patterns of the past and then extrapolate to the future. So let's do a political chart of the past and discover its pattern. I'm not going to go back to Adam and Eve this afternoon, only to 1776. In the graph of capitalism, the high point, the spike top, so to speak, was the founding fathers of the United States. This was the breakout for individual liberty after centuries of tyranny. The cause, by the way, was the three ideas we've talked about in the form of the Enlightenment philosophy held by the founding fathers. For a century after the founding fathers, the graph shows little change. The line representing capitalism stays approximately constant. Parenthetically, so did the country's basic ideas during this century. In the 1860s, the graph starts gradually to go down, taking its first steep drop during the Progressive Era at the start of the 20th century. What was the cause? The massive importation into the United States after the Civil War of German philosophy, the philosophy of Kant, then Hegel and Marx, which was the complete opposite of the founding fathers on every one of the three big issues. In other words, the intellectuals after the Civil War turned in a body against the founding ideas of America. Politics followed as a result. The next sharp drop down was the New Deal, which was a mere continuation of the progressive trend. The intellectuals still held the same ideas and were carrying them out, and they still do today. Since World War II, the graph of freedom in the United States shows a steady drift downwards. More gradually than before, there's been no recent precipitous drops, but no rises at all, and not even any constant periods anymore. Always down, down, down. Under Republicans and Democrats alike, right on through today and Ronald Reagan. As to Mr. Reagan's administration, is widely recognized as a total fiasco. Not only has he capitulated formally to the statism of the moral majority fundamentalists and caved in repeatedly to the aggressions of Soviet Russia, even on domestic economic policy, even on budget cutting, he has been a disaster. For details on this point, I refer you to David Stockman's book, The Triumph of Politics, which outlines in all its gory detail the sheer cowardice of the Reaganites, their fear of challenging seriously any of the massive entitlement programs, such as Social Security and Medicare, which are now out of control and threatening this nation with bankruptcy. Why are the Reaganites so cowardly? It's not merely that Mr. Reagan's advisors know nothing but the political expediency of the moment, or that Mr. Reagan himself is hardly an intellectual or a revolutionary. Most of all, it is because Mr. Reagan and his friends really are Christians, as they repeatedly tell us. And the altruist, self-sacrificial ethics they accept thereby makes it impossible for them, on moral grounds, to challenge the welfare state. The total chart we have been surveying looks grim. If we have to extrapolate from the trend of the past century through the present day, there is no hope. But do we have to? There was a breakout once before for freedom. Is there a chance for another in our time? I would say it all depends on the intellectuals. The people in this country are much better than the professors. They still respect the heritage of the founding fathers, but they are helpless against today's universities, which are the home of the intellectuals who determine the country's guiding ideas and are now setting the status trend. What we need desperately is what Ayn Rand called new intellectuals, the kind of thinkers who would defend the right philosophic fundamentals. A national movement of such thinkers is the only thing that could still save this country. But that requires a massive educational effort leading to a philosophic revolution. Is there time for an educational movement to succeed before a runaway inflation or a nuclear war or some other disaster strikes and stampedes us to dictatorship? As an objectivist, I hold that reality is not set against man and that there is no predetermined doom. So long as men are still alive and have the freedom to speak out, they have a chance. In this case, a chance to blast the crumbling mixed economy and establish a system of pure laissez-faire capitalism. But that chance depends on today's universities. Our universities today, I know whereof I speak because I taught in them for many years, East and West, arts and science and business, graduate and undergraduate. Our universities today, especially their social science and humanities departments, are totally under the sway of German philosophy. In other words, of all the ideas at the base of socialism. They are not only solidly anti-capitalist, most of them will not even give capitalism a hearing. I'm talking about real capitalism, not the mess we have today. For all practical purposes, the universities in the United States may as well be under censorship. Although they profess to be open to all viewpoints, in fact, they are not. Most of them are no longer educational institutions, but propaganda machines, which allow every variant of dissent imaginable, except real dissent. In other words, dissent which threatens today's philosophic establishment. If you want details about this situation at your school, the University of Pennsylvania, please ask me during the question period. So long as this situation in the colleges continues, then I have to answer our question today, no. Capitalism cannot survive if students do not even know what it is or that it's possible to defend it. It cannot survive if students do not start picketing their philosophy departments and demanding something better than the stuff now being dished out everywhere. I would never ask for equal time for pro-capitalist professors. That would be utopian. A 1 in 100 ratio would be enough. One pro-capitalist to 100 socialists. It would be enough to give the students the knowledge that there is an alternative. The better students could then judge the case on its merits. But today we are nowhere near even 1 in 100. So I can only answer our question today provisionally. If the universities introduce a modicum of fairness, then I would say yes, capitalism can and will survive. But if not, then I predict for the United States continued demoralization and eventual collapse, ending in dictatorship, probably of a fascist kind. Historically speaking, unfortunately, it is late, very late. No country in history, to my knowledge, has ever traveled as far down the road to dictatorship as we have, and then stopped before plunging over the brink. Perhaps America, which was once the greatest nation in history, can still do it. When I was young, in my 20s, 30s, 40s, I used to think it could. But at this point, in my 50s, although I'm still fighting, I don't know anymore. The outlook seems increasingly black. I'm sorry, therefore, that the most positive thing I can say in conclusion is only a bromide. Where there's life, there's hope. At least, I hope there is. Thank you. All right, we'll have questions now. I'm a little short-sighted, so if you wave, I can see motion. Yes. I don't know, can everyone hear that question? Do you want me to repeat? In essence, the lady asks whether I'll have to give my own words because it went on too long for me to retain all of it, but whether capitalism is pure capitalism would really be consistent with man's rights because through the medium of advertising it would inculcate in people a desire for goods that they couldn't fully satisfy and then they would be frustrated and presumably would rebel or steal or whatever. I don't accept that view, of course, at all. First of all, I don't define rights as the right to anybody else's property or anybody else's action. Right is the right to act and to keep the products of your own action, and that is what capitalism protects. Obviously, you couldn't have such a system without having, first of all, a society strongly committed to the virtue of justice and a whole ethical code. But justice specifically means you cannot crave, expect, demand, or want the unearned. If you want something, you have to pay for it. Therefore, under capitalism, at the same time that you would be nourishing in people a desire for material wealth, you would be nourishing in them the desire to acquire the skills and grow and have the ambition to be able to afford it. The situation that we have that the lady describes is very appropriate today in a situation where the media bombard people with the message of the value of goods and at the same time that if you are poor, you have a right to it because you're poor. Well, that, of course, is goading people to any kind of violence or to revolution. But the solution is get rid of the controls and teach people the virtue of justice. Then you will have wealth for everyone, relatively speaking. Someone near the back? Yes. Well, you're asking me a psychological question, really. What makes people drawn to the idea of self-sacrifice? I could give a lot of bad motivations. Perhaps the most obvious one is I'll give you a quote from the Fountainhead. Wherever there's someone offering sacrifices, there's somebody collecting them. Therefore, self-sacrifice always implies two ends, the giver and the receiver. And there are a great many people who preach self-sacrifice because they want to be on the receiving end. That's the big thing today. That is the whole new wave of American culture, to organize a group and announce you don't have something, whatever. You don't have public respect, you don't have enough jobs, you don't have whatever it is you want, therefore everybody should sacrifice and give it to you. It's a device to make whoever has a value feel guilty in order to give it to whoever doesn't have it. That's what they call egalitarianism, or the transfer of wealth, and what the grease that motivates it is guilt. And I think that that's one of the tremendous advantages of it, but that's speaking on a psychological level. Philosophically, I would say the deepest explanation lies in the fundamentals of philosophy. Ethics is just a derivative. No ethics starts by itself. The ethics of self-sacrifice rests on the idea. Always did. It's the religious ethics, and it rests on the idea of a supernatural dimension that you must accept on faith. Once you say, my mind is not valid, who am I to question or to think? My reason is inadequate. I have to listen to the commandments or the revelations of the religious authority or the state authority, in either case. Then obviously any dictator has a setup to then come along and tell you what you should do is give away everything according to my dictates. And self-sacrifice follows as the ethical expression of that fundamental. In other words, if you are brought up, yours is not to reason why. You won't reason why when someone tells you to become a serf, which is what the ethics of self-sacrifice actually tells you. This is why every dictator has preached self-sacrifice, and why you never heard a communist or a Nazi or any of their equivalent stand up before the country and say, you have a right to live for your own happiness. Don't let anybody stand in his way. If Hitler had said that, he would have to retire. So it comes back to, do you believe in reason or not? And now if you ask me, why don't people believe in reason, that's another question. But at least you didn't ask me that. Yes? You're entirely correct that objectivism opposes libertarianism. It's hard to say which we oppose more, libertarianism or religious conservatism. But it's hard to say. Whichever one I denounce last is the one I'm most against. The reason that we oppose libertarianism is precisely because we believe that the battle for the world rests in the fundamental ideas I was discussing, in philosophy. We don't think politics stands by itself, that you can argue politics out of context, or that politics determines the state of the world. We think politics is a consequence of your view of the mind, reality, of ethics. And therefore, for us, we'd be content never to discuss capitalism, never to discuss any of these political things, just discuss the fundamentals on the grounds that that would take care of the political battle. Now, the libertarians take exactly the reverse view. Their view is the only thing that counts is liberty. That's, you know, they start with that word, without a definition and without a foundation. Therefore, they say, to hell with philosophy. It doesn't make any difference what you believe. You can be a Buddhist, a follower of John Stuart Mill, you can be an anarchist, you can be, whatever. They have every conceivable and many inconceivable groups in their outfit. And the idea is we dismiss philosophy. All we unite on is that we're for liberty. Well, we believe that is a completely perverted way of approaching the battle, that it's doomed to failure, and that all it does is to make capitalism disreputable. When you see the type of, I don't like to engage in ad hominem, but I don't know how to say it factually, the weirdos that come out for capitalism under those auspices, I mean, it's all I can do to not become a socialist when I hear it. So, now your question was, does that movement give me hope? No. The only thing that gives me any hope is that sometimes there are people that drop out of libertarianism, and they will write me, for instance, and say, I used to think that that was a decent movement, but I got into it and I saw what it's like, and now, you know, I've seen the light. But I wish I could come to you in good conscience and say, I know hundreds of thousands of these people all over the country. There's tremendous hope. I don't know that many. I'm sorry. Jay, yes. Well, we are certainly in a very difficult situation. The question was, aren't we in a vicious circle? Because you say the students should picket for more capitalist professors, but the students don't know enough about capitalism to picket for them. So you have to have the students before the professors and the professors before the students. You're right, that is a dreadful situation. And that's one of the reasons why I say the outlook is so black. But I do not believe political action is the way out. Political activity... As an educational form is a complete waste. You can't educate people on philosophy in a campaign speech or a 30-second television spot. So that all that happens is when someone runs for politics, they get co-opted immediately by the establishment, the media petrify them, their opponents portray them as monsters, and they back down and abandon anything they stand for. It's too early to run for office. Much too early, in my opinion. So the only way out is education. Now you have a good question. Educate who, how, if you're frozen out of the universities? The only answer to that is try to beat your way into the universities. And that can be done on a very gradual, occasional basis. There are some objectivist professors here or there. And one of the main mission of the Ayn Rand Institute, which was started by Ed Snyder and myself and a few others, was specifically and primarily to get objectivism a hearing on campus. And there are Ayn Rand clubs now on, I don't know how many, 50 or 100 or something campuses. They bring speakers in. I believe a group, one of the groups sponsoring me today is one of these. Isn't that? Yeah, objectivist at Penn. But it's a drop in the bucket. I mean, what can 1 hour against the vast colossus do? Nevertheless, I know of no other way than write, lecture, urge anybody else who does knows the same, do it, and see what can be done. The only organized thing I can think is what the Institute is trying to do. Publicize objectivism and let the objectivist intellectuals be at least given a hearing, you see. I'm trying to take one question from each different person, so if you've asked before, yes. What I do want to say, since you've given me the opening, is what I had in mind about the situation at the University of Pennsylvania, which I'll confine it since it's late to this much. Some years back, Mr. Snyder decided that the University of Pennsylvania, now this is the other, the Arts and Science School, not Wharton, that we're talking about, was not offering the students a defense of capitalism. And he came to the then president and dean, it was at that time Dean Gregorian, over at Penn and put to them, you correct me if I'm wrong on any details here, put to them the proposal that they the philosophy department should offer a course in Ayn Rand's philosophy as a defense of capitalism. One course. That's it. Against how many? 50 or 75 or 100 of the opposite. Well, there was a big to-do about it. They wanted to know my credentials, and that was all I was suggested as the one to teach it, and that was hard to get around. So then they wanted a syllabus, and we did all the readings and all the scholarly things. That was all there. It was then was stated they don't think there would be enough of a student demand for such a course. So they proposed, I believe they proposed, and they attest that I should give a lecture in the Arts and Science School on the philosophy of Ayn Rand and see if there was enough interest on the part of the students, because the argument was, what's the use of our putting a course in the catalog if no one's going to come to it, or it's just going to be, you know, two or three people. And this was, what, 78, I think, or something like that. So they, now you tell me the figures, I can't remember. They had a room that held 200, I think, 300, and how many showed up? 800 people came to the lecture. They were flowing from the chandeliers. There was a very lengthy question period, and it wasn't all just partisans. There was a lot of antagonism that I generated, too. But in any event, it was very clear that there was tremendous interest. And we went back to a cocktail party with the philosophy department, and we were told that this didn't prove anything because there had been an advertisement for the course, and therefore the demand was distorted. For my lecture, there had been an advertisement. And therefore, the test was invalidated, and one member of the philosophy department actually had the effrontery to go up to Mr. Snyder at this cocktail party and say, we will offer a course on Ayn Rand's philosophy if you will give $1 million to the philosophy department. To which Mr. Snyder said, I have a better idea. We'll fire you and replace you with somebody better. Now, that was the last that we ever heard about a course at the University of Pennsylvania. The only follow-up to this story, now this part, up to here I can verify, this part I can't verify, it might be just gossip that someone told me. Several students wrote me the next several months that someone from the philosophy department had gone to the bookstore and asked that Ayn Rand's books be removed on the grounds that it was causing his students to ask irrelevant questions in class. Now, what's the use of having the First Amendment? Practically speaking, you may as well not have it. That is my actual view. I'm trying to get different people in the purple back there. How will we get around the fact that most individuals haven't got the time, in effect, to go into philosophic depth and so on? You're entirely right. You get around it very simply. That is true of every movement throughout history. History is made by a very, very small number of individuals. If you look at any movement, you will see that it started with some one individual who had a small group who then influenced the next generation and the next, and it gradually spread. It can take a long time. Now, for instance, Christianity took 4 centuries. From the time when it was a crackpot, that's how Jesus was regarded. A crackpot Jewish rebel
with a few followers, to become the dominant movement in the ancient world. We don't have four centuries today, unfortunately. Marx did it much faster, but it still took him a long time. But the key point is, it doesn't take a lot of people, it takes a few. Lenin is supposed to have written a letter before communism took over in Russia. And it's supposed to have contained the sentence, there are now seven people who completely understand the philosophy of the revolution. The success of the revolution is assured. And now that, historically speaking, is correct. Now, seven, maybe we could go up to 17, would be helpful. But relative to the millions and billions of people on the face of the earth, you do not need quantity. You need a few who really understand, but then you need the generations required for that understanding to become books, which then becomes courses, which then becomes, you know, the next level and the next level. And the question in my mind, to which I don't have an answer, is do we have the time for that? I don't know. I once thought we did. Now I don't know. Yes. No, I completely reject and repudiate anarchism. I think the idea of private governments and competing governments is completely worthless and completely nonsensical. And I'll put it to you this simply. I belong to, let us say, Government A, which operates out of the Wharton School. And you belong to Government B, which operates out of Temple. And I charge you with a violation of my property rights and sic my police on you, and you call yours, and what happens then? Then you just have civil war. Competing governments is another name for gang warfare. It is nonsensical and has to lead only to dictatorship. The flaw in this country was not its theory of government. The flaw was that they based that theory of government on an allegedly Judeo-Christian ethics. That is, they tried to say, let's have rights, liberty, the individual, and the ethics of service and sacrifice for others. And you cannot combine it. Ethics is more basic than politics. In any clash between the two, given time, ethics has to win over politics. And therefore, the trouble was not the politics of this country, but the fact that it never had the philosophic, specifically the ethical base that it needed. And that is just what I think objectivism and Ayn Rand provided. I guess on that note, we better draw a line. Thank you very much for your attention.